Today on the LA Food Podcast, I'm your host, Lucas Servodio, taking a page out of Tina Turner's playbook because this episode is all about simply the best. We're joined by Brand Cox and Silvio Martins of the Infatuation LA to break down their list of the best new restaurants of 2023. They dropped this list a couple of weeks ago now, and it includes some truly stellar spots that have graced the LA dining scene this past year, such as Donna's of Echo Park and Loretto of Frogtown. Brant and Silvio walk us through their process for compiling this list. We learn about their favorites, honorable mentions that just missed out, and why some big names like Funky and Poltergeist didn't quite make the cut. We also talk food trends of 2023, from the Great Martini revival to the seemingly inescapable barrage of red sauce Italian spots flooding our timelines, and they look forward to 2024, discussing which upcoming restaurant openings have them chomping at the bit. First, though, there are a couple of headlines in the food world I wanted to discuss, from LA's alfresco program moving towards permanence to the closure of several big-name restaurants. That's coming up next. So without further ado, let's chow down. Hello, dear listener. I hope you are gearing up for a restful and peaceful holiday season. I'm really excited about today's conversation with Brant and Silvio from The Infatuation, but before we get into that, I wanted to quickly tell you about a few headlines and bits of news and meals that really stuck out to me in the past couple of weeks. First, there's been a lot of talk about alfresco dining in Los Angeles. This was basically the program that was introduced during the pandemic by the city council to allow restaurants to have outdoor space without certain pre-pandemic zoning restrictions that used to exist. These were things like noise ordinances or the number of seats you could have on a property. These were all relaxed during the pandemic in order to allow restaurants to survive, right, by welcoming diners outdoor. Since then, there's been a lot of discussion about what to do now that things have gone back to allowing for people to dine inside. A lot of restaurateurs have argued, hey, during the pandemic, we spent a lot of money to put up these outdoor dining zones. They really helped us. They've allowed us to expand our business. And frankly, it would be a huge pain and kind of unfair, frankly, to ask us to take these down. A lot of restaurants also have now come to rely on these. Maybe they were just, you know, small takeout windows before, but now that they can have the alfresco dining outside, it's added an entire new dimension to their business. So there's been discussions in recent months, and we had Casa Vega's Christy Vega on the podcast several months ago to talk to us about the situation. And, you know, it's been clear that there's been sort of a push and pull between restaurateurs and the city council about how to make this program permanent. The city council has wanted to do it in ways that don't piss off neighborhoods and neighborhood councils while still allowing restaurateurs to operate. But it's been tricky. It's been tricky to find a solution. However, a couple Fridays ago at City Hall, the city council requested that the city attorney draft an ordinance to make the alfresco program permanent. Basically, they came to a number of agreements with the restaurateurs and the other folks who have been advocating for the alfresco dining to come up with basically the rules and the roadway for an ordinance that would make everybody happy. So this is a good step. This is a good step in the right direction for making those beautiful outdoor dining patios that we've all come to love so much permanent. Of course, there are still a couple of issues. First, the city council have included a requirement that restaurants include a parking spot for people with disabilities. Now, on its face, this seems like a great, fantastic thing. We should be making ways for people with disabilities to enjoy all of our restaurants. However, as you can imagine, this can be tougher for smaller restaurants. Let's say you're a restaurant that has a very small outdoor parking lot. Maybe you only have one parking spot. Well, if that parking spot has to become a parking spot for people with disabilities, then you no longer have outdoor seating. So that kind of defeats the purpose of the alfresco dining to begin with, right? So This is kind of a little bit of a point of contention. The city has proposed including an exception for small restaurants, restaurants with small square footage. But of course, this in turn has angered people with disabilities who say there shouldn't be exceptions. We need to be able to park in order to be able to go enjoy these restaurants. So a little bit of a tricky situation and definitely one to watch. The second remaining point of contention with the alfresco dining are noise complaints. Noise complaints is the other issue. Basically, one thing that restaurants had to agree to in order for the city council to really move forward with the alfresco dining, restaurants had to be like, look, I know that one thing that is preventing the city council from just greenlighting the alfresco dining program is they're worried about neighborhoods and neighborhood councils complaining about noise. So we restaurants, we're willing to get rid of ambient and live music so that we can guarantee, you know, as quiet conditions as possible for the neighborhoods in which we operate. They've done that. City council was happy with that. However, there's still people who aren't happy with this. There's people in neighborhoods who say, okay, it's great that the restaurants have agreed to do this, but it's going to be really hard to enforce. Who's to say a restaurant won't just play ambient music and then if a neighbor puts in a complaint when the police shows up or whoever, the restaurant can just turn down the music and say, we weren't playing music, you know, nothing to see here. I think this is kind of like one of those NIMBY not in my backyard complaints that isn't actually real. So I wouldn't put a ton of stock into it, but it's another thing to watch in terms of what could potentially derail these discussions. All in all, I think this is a great step. I think alfresco dining has added so much to our city, and I'm really stoked to see it become permanent. And I think it's been a great thing to give a lot of businesses a leg up. And honestly, keep supporting your restaurants. Keep going to their alfresco patios. These restaurants have put a ton of money and thought into those patios, so we should be enjoying them. I think it's the least we can do. One more thing, or a couple other things. Three new LA restaurants were added to Michelin's California Guide. So even though the next sort of Michelin Guide won't be released until next year, Michelin does this like weird thing where they sort of like tease what restaurants might be added later on by adding them as quote unquote discoveries to the California Guide. And they added three Los Angeles discoveries to the California Guide, all of which have sort of like Korean influences. One is Baru in the Arts District, one is Hebe in Koreatown, and the other is Olivia in Koreatown. Now, I think this is a really cool move from Michelin. Baru obviously is an incredible restaurant. I only went to Baru 1.0 back in the day, but Baru 2.0 has opened in the Arts District and by all accounts is fantastic. I can't wait to go. I was particularly pleased to see Olivia get a shout. Now, for those who don't know, Olivia is a strip mall restaurant in Koreatown that is vegetarian, not vegan, vegetarian. It's interesting because one of the owners is Anderson Paak of musical fame, who I have a soft spot for. And I went to dinner here with my wife several months ago, and I gotta say, I was quite pleased with the food. The food overall, it skews kind of Italian. They do pastas and pizzas, and it's all vegetarian, but you know, for a lot of those pastas and pizzas, being vegetarian doesn't really take away much, right? You can make an excellent dough and top it with a bunch of fresh produce, and it's gonna be fantastic. And that is one thing I really appreciated about Olivia, and that was their pizza was fantastic. The dough was really good. It was this very sort of like light, bubbly, crackly affair, and it stood up really nicely to the topics. We got their Jimmy Nardella, which was a saucy, veggie-forward thing with a little bit of spice from peppers. I really appreciated the pizza. We also got a pasta. I believe it was like a mushroom ragu situation. Super like hearty, comforting, pure, simple dish. The only thing that really stood out to me about Olivia when I went was it was empty. Like, my wife and I were like the only people there. Admittedly, we got there at like 5 p.m. because we were going to a show later that night. But even by the time we left, there were only like three other diners there. So my hope is that by being added to the Michelin Guide, you know, Olivia can see a little bit more success. That would make me very happy. You know, it's hard out there for restaurants. So they can use all the accolades they receive, and hopefully this is going to help Olivia as well as the other restaurants. So that's a perfect way to segue into the next topic, which is restaurant closures. You know, unfortunately, there continue to be tons and tons of restaurant closures rolling out towards the end of the year. A couple that have come across my social media feed in the last couple of days are Angry Egret in Chinatown, which of course was Wes Avila's fantastic torta window. They've said that initially Angry Egret was supposed to be just a 3-month project, like around the time of the pandemic. But after its initial success, they extended that lease to be 3 years. And now they're coming to the end of their 3-year lease and they're not going to renew. And that makes me really sad. I mean, Angry Egret was a frankly beautiful little space. It was Wes Avila's sort of like next venture after the success of Gorilla Tacos. He left Gorilla Tacos where there was a very like well-established menu after several years, which was still really good, but had lost a bit of like the experimentation that made Gorilla Tacos so great when it first opened as like a roaming operation back in the Arts District. He had sort of rediscovered a lot of that experimentation that I'm sure never went away in the background, but that we weren't seeing as much as diners when we were eating. And he rediscovered that and redisplayed a lot of that through Angry Egret. And it was a fantastic place to eat. Every single time you went to Angry Egret, there was something new on the menu. It was always rotating, but they also had like tried and true classics. I included them on my recent sort of like archive of the 100 best sandwiches in Los Angeles that I just completed, by the way. So go to the LA Countdown to check that out. But their tortas were fantastic. And my favorite was a breakfast torta that had egg and sausage and a little bit of avocado. It was just very simple, but just very well executed. They supported local vendors. They got their bolillos from La Princesita in Boyle Heights. You know, it's a place that's going to be sorely missed. Of course, this does open up the window for Wes Avila to do something else, and I can't wait to see what he does. Couple other closures just to mention real quick. Etta in Culver City. We discussed this on the pod several months ago, but it sounds like some bad shit was happening there behind the scenes. So while my heart goes out to the staff and all the people who are going to lose their jobs because of this, it sounds like it was a bad situation. And hopefully those people land somewhere else that's going to treat them a little bit better. Craft LA, Tom Colicchio's Craft LA closed. This one's just a little bit sad because, you know, on this podcast, we're big fans of Top Chef. We're big fans of Tom. So seeing Tom's cooking leave the city is a little bit sad. But, you know, you never know where he might pop up again, that Tom Colicchio. And finally, this one is particularly troubling, was the closure of Kin in Koreatown. The chef, Ki Kim, I believe his name is, he cited mental health and physical health struggles, basically just saying like, yo, it's been tough and I don't think I can do this anymore. I really need to step away and I don't know if I'm ever going to reopen this. And I kind of just need you guys to be okay with that. It was a very like honest message that he posted on social media, and it really tugged at my heartstrings because I think sometimes we forget as diners when we're sitting around just like critiquing restaurants and all and basically like nitpicking their like little flaws in dishes or flaws that we perceive, which might not even be flaws. These are human beings behind the scenes. This is what they do. Sometimes it's their passion. A lot of times it's just their job. And it's hard. It's a really hard industry. It's physically demanding. It's mentally demanding. The economics are tough. And I think this is just an example of a really talented younger chef who, I don't want to say flew too close to the sun, but certainly, you know, experienced a lot of success, experienced it very quickly. And, you know, suffered some side effects. So, you know, our heart goes out to him and hopefully we'll see him back at some point, but we're definitely rooting for Key. Final thing I just want to mention really quickly is we had a fantastic dinner at Birdie G's. We went there for their 8 nights of Birdie G's. It was the David Kinch menu. And I just got to say, I'd been to Rustic Canyon before. I had never been to Birdie G's, but after Chef Jeremy Fox came on the podcast and I heard all about sort of his like philosophy, his story, I was like, I gotta get to Birdie G's ASAP, so I made it out there for the 8 nights of Birdie G's. And oh my God, guys, this is some of the most incredible food I think you can have in Los Angeles right now. I won't talk too much about the specific David Kinch menu because it was just a one-off thing that you could only get that night. However, it doesn't matter because the best thing I had all night is something that you can get from Birdie G's menu at any given time. And that was their persimmons and burrata dish. Now, I shouldn't say you can get it at any time because I'm sure it's seasonal. It's the kind of restaurant that does swap out dishes. But certainly if persimmons are in season, get your ass to Birdie G's. Yes, the persimmons were fantastic. The burrata was sublime. But what I really loved was they used a little bit of yuzu to brighten it up, which fantastic, right? Yuzu, more interesting than just using some other acid like lemon. It's got those beautiful like floral notes. But the true genius move is they added this dehydrated like powder, which consisted of dehydrated anchovies, garlic, and capers. It was almost like Caesar salad pop rocks without the like annoying fizz. It was incredible. Added this like really great brininess to the whole dish, really tied all of the ingredients together. I absolutely loved it. All right, that's probably enough of a quote-unquote monologue from me. So without further ado, let's get into our conversation with Brant and Silvio. Joining us on the LA Food Podcast today are two folks you've probably seen on your social media feeds. If, like me, you're an avid follower of all things food and restaurants in Los Angeles, it's the Infatuation LA's Brant Cox and Silvio Martins. Brant, let me start with you since you're a returning guest to the pod. How are you doing today?
You know, I'm doing great. It is, it's really fun to be back. It's good to hang out.
You may be one of the first returning guests that's not Father Saul. So, you know, it's good validation that we didn't scare you away.
That's true. That's actually really true. I had to think about it, but I'm here.
Good to know. Hey, I've enjoyed some of the social media content you've appeared in lately. And I must ask, do you actually get ambushed as you're exiting the bathroom for takes? Or do you know to expect something like that?
Sadly, it is an ambush. It is our ambush. Yeah. Our wonderful social media manager, Nicholas, who you've seen probably more than us on social media, he is relentless and he'll find you anywhere.
That's what makes good content though, right?
Truly. It's just absolutely going for it.
Silvio, lovely to meet you. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great. Thank you for having me. This is my first ever podcast.
First ever podcast?
I'm an avid podcast listener, but this is my first time actually like appearing on a podcast.
Yeah, well then I'm sure you'll appreciate there are no other good food podcasts in LA, so I appreciate you making time for ours.
That's right.
Look, I believe last time Brant told us that his LA stomping grounds were like mid-city area, but where are you calling us from today?
Actually, I live in the same area. Brant's not too far from me. So coincidentally, we're coming from the same exact part of town.
No way. So is there like a requirement to live in that area if you work at the Infatuation?
There is a bonus.
Yeah.
You are centrally located. It is kind of nice.
Yeah, you can make your way to just about any part of town that you need to be covering. So that absolutely makes sense. What are your favorite spots to eat in the neighborhood, Silvio?
Ooh, let's see. There's an Indian spot on Wilshire called India's Tandoori that I get takeout from all the time. It's a really delicious, quick, casual place. It's a huge takeout operation, so I like to get like a late night saag paneer, chana masala, biryani. They have a great lamb biryani. I love to get pastries in the morning at Republique. Just kind of do the morning line, grab a box of pastries, move on with my day. And there's a Dr. Sandwich location here on Beverly that does a really nice like chicken shawarma salad that is kind of on my rotation for lunch pickups.
Yeah, it sounds fantastic. I'm glad you mentioned the Indian place because Father Saul and I broke down your guys' best Indian and Pakistani restaurants list a few weeks ago, which we really appreciated. In fact, Father Saul is of Pakistani descent, and he really appreciated the Pakistani representation on that list. So really cool list. Well, speaking of lists, we are rapidly approaching the end of the year, crazily enough, and you've all released an exciting list of the best new restaurants 2023. Brant, let's start with you. How does this list come together?
Well, I think it's a couple things. I think the first thing you have to realize is this is truly a 12-month long process. The day that we published Best New Restaurants of 2022, the next day we started thinking about Best New Restaurants 2023. We have an internal saying that we said it's always BNR season. And that means, you know, this isn't a process where, you know, all of a sudden at the end of, you know, beginning of November, we come together and we're like, all right, what's our favorite spots? This is an ongoing 12-month long process. And in a very basic term, these are the 12 highest rated reviews that we published this year. Now, you know, over the course of 12 months, right, like you could have a really highly rated restaurant in January, February, March, April. And when those restaurants are published, they're in a high rating, a rating that we usually see on a best new restaurants list. Like it's high enough to probably be like, you know, maybe at the end of the year, this might be one of those places. We basically just bookmark it, but the team is constantly going back to it, right? It's not like we just shelve it and, you know, leave it alone, right? The team, the entire LA team is constantly revisiting, going back. And then come October, November, when we're sitting down to really start finalizing this best new restaurants list, we pull those restaurants, right? And basically re-audit them. Because restaurants change. Restaurants could have a really wildly successful opening. They're hitting on all cylinders. And then 9-10 months later, maybe they're not quite as good, or reverse, right? Like sometimes places open up quietly. Maybe they haven't, you know, fully rolled out their menu or all, you know, parts of service of the day, whatever it is. And then come six, 7 months later, they're hitting on all cylinders. That's something we're going to take into account. And we have absolutely bumped ratings up because we believe a place has deserved it over the course of the year. That happened this year. In particular, this place, Ruby Fruit, which is a queer wine bar in Silver Lake. It opened in, I want to say, February, March. We loved it, have always loved it. Gave a really good rating for it. And then over the course of the year, in the summer, they started introducing, filling out their menu, kind of debuting this absolutely incredible lunch service that really became the crux of like the main review and why we, you know, on top of all the stuff that's going on there, like why it was particularly so exciting. And so we actually this year bumped it up the rating. So because we felt it deserved to be in the best new restaurants. So as I said, that's kind of the process throughout the year. I mean, we are going to hundreds of restaurants. I mean, myself, Silvio, our other writers, it's not uncommon for us to go to 5 to 10 different restaurants a week. And, you know, so this is a deeply vetted process that does not happen overnight.
So you've got like a spreadsheet. Do you have some sort of like spreadsheet that keeps track of how many times you've been to a certain restaurant in order to like sort of identify, we got to hit this a few more times, we have some blind spots here and whatnot, until you feel like you have a good enough handle of that particular restaurant?
Absolutely. We have all sorts of documents and sheets and intel. And then honestly, if somebody, you know, a team member goes to a place and says, hey, I had a weird experience here, or like this was different, or hey, this dish that we loved isn't on the menu anymore, we're going to make that part of the data and just be like, okay, all right, that's good to know. We're going to check in on that. And so it's an evolving beast, honestly. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I really appreciated the sort of like fun stats on the side of the article where it's like, you know, 20 shrimp heads at Barra Santos consumed and whatnot. So I loved that little touch. Silvio, question for you. Is there a cutoff numerically rating wise at which you no longer include a restaurant? It seemed like the restaurant ratings on this list petered off around 8.5. Is that sort of like the minimum cutoff for this list?
I would say that every year is totally different. We just kind of decided that it was getting long and we decided to cut it off at 12. And that number was kind of where we landed for this year. But, you know, Brant kind of mentioned it. We like to think of the site and our rating system as this like living, breathing thing that it constantly fluctuates and things change. And we kind of just like take BNR, best new restaurants, you know, we do it uniquely and differently every single year. And we just cater it to that specific year. So this year it landed on 12. 8.5 was kind of like the cutoff that it was the natural cutoff.
Of this list, are there any that you would consider favorites or that are particularly near and dear to your heart?
every restaurant on this list, it's the best new restaurants of 2023, according to us. So we love all these spots. A personal favorite of mine, and I know like Brant shares these feelings, is Loretto over in Frogtown or Elysian Valley, depending on how you call it. We love the space. It's a beautiful space. They do a combination of really classic mariscos dishes, like Mexican, like a seafood, like a sarandiao. But they also do like really creative and innovative things like a papaya salad tostada, or like they do like a scallop tostada with this like wasabi cream that's delicious. And they also opened up Zazaza, which is like a lunchtime window that you can go to, and you can have like a michelada, you can have a cóctel, you can have really amazing fish tacos on their beautiful patio. So it's like, that was a restaurant that kind of was like the gift that kept on giving this year. I loved Barra Santos. I wrote that review and I thoroughly enjoyed all my visits there. It's a walk-in only spot, so you can't plan to go there besides just like what time you're going to show up. If they're like, hey, it's 30 minutes for a table, it's a small space, you're kind of forced to slow down, sit outside, have a glass of wine, talk to your friend that you brought to this place. And it's something that's like really rare in the city to kind of really be forced to slow down and enjoy the dining process. And I think that's a really special component. We had two taquerias on this list that was not something we had last year. We had Tacos Los Cholos, which is originally from Orange County, and opened up a brick and mortar in Huntington Park. And it's, I would say, the best tacos al carbón I've had ever in Los Angeles. It's really good Mexican barbecue that gets transported via a taco. And it's very, very good. We had Tacos La Rueda in Bellflower that does like Sonoran style tacos. My family's actually from Sonora. So to see something so real, like the quality of the flour tortilla, the quality of the asada, the salsas, everything was so good. And yeah, really exciting year for Mexican food in LA. And I think BNR really reflects that.
Yeah, that's really cool. How about you, Brent? Any ones that near and dear to your heart?
The obvious choice, the highest rated restaurant of the year, was La Dolce Vita in Beverly Hills, a place that I honestly loved the second I walked in. I have such a personal kink for like revitalized Hollywood history, and I think they did such a great job of just bringing back this kind of forgotten piece of the city. And you know, you just walk in there and it's just kind of maximalist and over the top, but also like really chic and exclusive, but exclusive in a way that like makes everybody feel like a part of the party. And the food is good too, right? It's, you know, it's that red sauce Italian, which we saw a lot this year. We'll talk about, you know, a little bit later, but it really kind of put that red sauce Italian thing and applied it into fine dining. And I think they knocked it out of the ballpark. I think the food is great. And it's more so just so much fun. I was telling Silvio earlier, you know, still feeling in the world like we're still kind of in the shadow of, you know, the post-pandemic shadow. It's like any place that I can walk into and it feels like a party where every single person is having fun, that feels like a novelty to me. Like it truly, it still takes my breath away because we went so long without it that like that still speaks so much to me. And not every restaurant has that, right? And La Dolce Vita to me has that.
Yeah, I went to the Polo Lounge for the first time last weekend just to get some like Christmas vibes, you know, like with the decorations and whatnot. And that is exactly the sort of environment that I thought we might never experience again post pandemic, like closed room, everybody together. It feels like a weird holiday party, even though it's not your office holiday party. So that spirit, I completely resonate with that.
Yeah, it hasn't gone old yet. Another place I loved is that kind of just felt like it dropped from the sky is Le Great Outdoor in Santa Monica, this outdoor grill it all. Like it kind of just feels like a community picnic of sorts. And you're on this giant asphalt lot in Santa Monica, and the food is great. They just bring all this meat and veggies right from the farmer's market. They grill it all. Everybody's out drinking wine. And honestly, like the fact that it's in Santa Monica is wild to me. I didn't think I thought we were done with those kind of places on the West Side. It's just so expensive over there that to have a place that's so kind of experimental and sort of just truly breaks the mold. Like I thought we were done seeing it over there, to be honest. And I think that place is really fun. I was really taken surprised by that.
For those who aren't as familiar with Le Great Outdoor, in what ways do you think it's breaking the mold?
Well, I think for one, you're literally on a parking lot. It's not full service. You order at the kind of this like table up front. You put in for, you know, the menu is like, I think I wrote in the review, it's like things that like your chef friend would bring to a potluck. It's like it's like corn and mm-hmm. and rhubarb and steak and chicken, but like then it arrives and it's beautiful and fresh and amazing, and you know, and then you just, no one's kicking you out. You can sit and drink wine in these picnic tables for as long as you want. You can watch the sunset. It really just feels like an outdoor barbecue with friends. And for me, that's, especially in that part of town, that's breaking the mold. We had a bunch of, you know, our New York coworkers would come out throughout the year, and a lot of them were going to the Great Outdoor, and, you know, they all loved it. And they all said, they were like, wow, this is like such of like the stereotypical LA restaurant, and they mean that in a good way. And I got what they were saying, but I also was like, but here's the thing. There's not restaurants that are like that here, really. Like It's this like kind of idea of what the LA stereotype is. You're outdoors, you're fresh vegetables from the farmer's market. It all hits the check marks. But then when you sit back and think about it, it's kind of the only one of its kind. And so I was like, yeah, it's this sort of LA stereotype, except it's kind of singular in its own experience.
Yeah, it feels almost like what people who aren't from Los Angeles might think like Jelena is, but it's really not that at all.
Yeah.
Jelena is like, Jelena has like the essence of that, but like full of influencers on Abercrombie kind of. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Sylvia, let me ask you, were there any restaurants that almost made it on the list but didn't? The honorable mentions, if you will.
There was a handful for sure. There's plenty. One that comes to mind is this one place that I reviewed over in Downey called El Muelle Ocho. It's a Mexican seafood spot originally from Culiacán, Mexico. It's like a Sinaloan style spot. So this was their second location ever, and obviously the first in the United States. And it's just like a small strip mall spot that they do these like this really, really good ceviche mix. So they have a few ceviches on the menu, and they have really beautiful tacos that are like, they're really creative with their sauces and their condiments. Like they go heavy on the condiments. So you could have like a whole ahi steak and a taco with this like really nice like spicy cream and like this like really delicious agua chile and this like charred tomatillo salsa. It's just a really special spot. And we covered it and it had a great response on social. So glad to see that people are enjoying it. But yeah, that comes to mind for me.
Another honorable mention, well, Zaza is another one, which Sylvia talked about, the place that's attached to Loretto. But one other one is Lorenzo, which is another place in Beverly Hills. I'll say Beverly Hills came out of nowhere this year with all kinds of places. But Lorenzo is a sandwich shop with these just unbelievably like decadent, beautiful Italian sandwiches that are just filled with like the most incredible things. And I, that place is like a personal favorite of mine. I go there a lot, and you just get these big, giant sandwiches with luxurious items or ingredients. And then you walk over to the park in front of the Beverly Hills sign, and you just feel like a rich person for 3 minutes. And it just, it just feels great. And like, man, those sandwiches are so good. And, you know, to that end, it's like, you know, we're talking about these places that didn't make it on best new restaurants, but we love them still. So, you know, it's to the point of like, even if it's not on best new restaurants, it's, but BNR is not the end of it all, right? For these places, we have a lot of editorial projects throughout the year with a lot that get a lot of eyeballs. We did this project called Summer 25, which is where we're kind of picking our fun 25 things to do around town. Zaza was featured on that. Lorenzo is going to be featured on one coming up. So just because it's not on best new restaurants doesn't mean it's like the forgotten child. Like, we have so many different avenues and ways to get eyeballs on the places that we love.
Yeah, that's a great thing about y'all's format with the types of lists y'all curate. I think that's, you're able to give a lot of different love to different restaurants, but also, you know, it
could happen that somebody's looking at your BNR list and just nothing really hits for them. You know what I mean? Like, it's not really their type of food or their type of restaurants or whatnot, but you have so many other lists for those kinds of people, which it's kind of the perfect one-stop shop for folks. So I know that last time you were on, Brant, you talked a little bit about how back at Infatuation HQ, you often get into some debates about, like, you know, how good a place is, or what is really so special about a place versus another spot and whatnot. And I am curious about this list, if any of these restaurants that we've talked about or any others sparked any sort of like fierce, intense internal debate about what made them special, or whether they were, you know, unique enough or right enough for the BNR list.
That's a great question. And debates happen all the time, right? And especially our team has gotten bigger and we've got more opinions and more people going to try all the places. This is going to be a boring answer, but this year was fairly debate-free. We felt really like kind of locked in with these places. We had all had gone to them several times. And as you pointed out, you know, in kind of the format we did this year, we literally listed the amount of team visits that we had. So, you know, we're all in for debate, and that's part of the, you know, that's part of the fun of it. But like this year, we actually really were lockstep, and sometimes it happens naturally, right? Like, and this year was sort of that. We looked at our list at our highly rated restaurants, and we were like, damn, this is a good list. Like, this is a good list, you know, because sometimes, you know, to no fault of anybody, you know, maybe one neighborhood has like five restaurants in it, right? And then at that point, maybe we'll take a step back and be like, all right, do all five of those restaurants in Echo Park, let's say, deserve to be on the list? And maybe they do, and we decide that. Or maybe we say, all right, if we had to pick three, which ones would they be? We didn't have any conversations like that this year because we didn't need to, but those are all things that we take into consideration. Or it's like, hey, do we have, you know, four pasta spots on here? Do they all need to be on here? Maybe, maybe not. So these are things we're, you know, always thinking about. But this year, honestly, we got lucky.
I think also the great thing about our team is that we trust each other's opinions. Like, yeah, genuinely, like we don't go to restaurants to kind of prove each other wrong or to kind of find holes in our arguments. It's really like, oh, okay, I take your word for it. And 99% of the time, I would say my coworkers are spot on. And this year we had this like selection of 12 truly excellent restaurants, and we were so unbelievably happy with the list.
This is my 8th, 9th best new restaurant list, and 8.5 is the highest number, is like the highest lowest number that of all. Like, there's been years past, actually pretty regularly, there will be an 8.1, 8.2 and up from the list. But this year started at 8.5, and that was the highest the bar has been since there hasn't been a best new restaurants without me around here. And so that just speaks to, we had a really good year of restaurants. The caliber of restaurants was really high.
Yeah, 8.5 is high. Like Pitchfork, their best new music category, I think they cap it at like 8.3. So 8.5, you know, you guys are out pitchforking Pitchfork right now.
That's right.
Let's talk big picture a little bit. So, Silvio, I'm going to give you an impossible task, but if you were to summarize 2023 as a year for restaurants in LA, how would you do it? Which themes did you pick up on?
Kind of similar to what Brant was saying about La Dolce Vita and how he feels like when he's in that room. I think people really just want to feel good in restaurants. They want to take in a crowd. They want to eat food that makes them feel good. I think we're not really in the time period of like unapproachable food, where food has to be very kind of stylized and abstract and broken down to a way that like the average diner can kind of has to feels like a meal is experimental, or, you know, like a new territory. Like, people really wanted to like feel at home in restaurants and really take it all in. So comfort, that's something we talk about in the intro in this year's Best New Restaurant. It was a year of, whether you interpret that as nostalgia or you interpret it as just like, I mean, sounds a little bit cliche, but like good vibes, you know, like people wanted to have fun. It was a year of having fun.
Yeah, I'm going to piggyback off of that. You know, it's like you can just fire up your news app to figure out why people want to feel good. And I think restaurants have become an outlet for that, right? And that includes fine dining like La Dolce Vita, or, you know, the two taquerias that we highlighted this year. Is like the common denominator is like people are going to these places to feel comforted for however long they're in there, forever, for however much money that they're spending there. It is this sense of comfort that that people want. And so I think that is the absolute through line.
Mm-hmm. That's cool. Let's talk about one of, you know, PR people's favorite topics when it comes to the end of the year, and that's trends. So we've talked a little bit about comfort. We've talked a little bit about community and coming together. What about specific like food trends? Are there any that like, I remember a few years ago was, I mean, maybe last year it was, I would have said it, tinned fish was what I saw everywhere, right? What food trends did you notice?
So I think, again, kind of bleeding into my last thing, without question, that sort of red sauce Italian thing, you know, and LA had a couple of very good versions of that. We had two of which made it onto our list. We've got the Dolce Vita, and then we have Donna's, which is still probably the hardest table to get in the city, over in Echo Park. And it's that chicken parm, garlic bread, Caesar, you know, all that, and martinis. And, you know, we had, like I said, these are really great examples of it. We'll see how long it lasts. But for now, I'm happy with it because these places are good. I think the things I don't, the trend that honestly, it can go away, and luckily I think it's already started to go away, is the whole caviar $50 add-on to anything thing. It like ridiculous. And like, honestly, justice for caviar. People have been eating that since the dawn of time, and it's become this sort of like this weird kind of social posturing sort of thing, being like, hey, I'm going to get this for absolutely no reason. And that can go away. Also, as someone who's been drinking martinis for a long time, I want the trend of martinis to go away so I can start drinking my martinis in peace again and not have them potentially be loaded with all sorts of ingredients and this and caviar and weird. Let's just go back to sipping martinis alone.
I don't think people actually like martinis. Like, maybe you do, but I feel like the vast majority of folks who have hopped on this trend, they're just doing it for the trend and like just accept the pain of pounding martinis to be cool.
That's probably right. Those are fighting words for me because I truly have martinis running through my body at all times, but I do love it, but I completely agree with you. I completely agree. People are just hopping on it because it's a TikTok trend.
Yeah, no, I was saying, yeah, you come present company excluded, of course.
I also enjoy a gin martini, and I can say that Brant Cox actually makes a very good gin martini. So I am pro martini. I would like them to just kind of die down in terms of complexity. I kind of just want a nice like gin martini at a restaurant. Trends that I'm excited about. I think like this year was huge on like big Italian sandwiches. And I personally don't want that to die down. I would like them to stay. Like Lorenzo in Beverly Hills, incredible. We have Tremani, which I wrote a review on over in Santa Monica. It's a collab between Gasalo and John Isaac. It's the schiacciata bread, like a Roman style flatbread that's like incredible. We have Antico Veneo from Florence that just opened up in on Abbekinney. We have Sonio Toscano in Santa Monica. Like, I'm never gonna turn down mortadella and prosciutto and, you know, like a sandwich. Like, it's great. And yeah, keep them coming. I'll have them. I'll eat them.
I agree. I feel like this summer it was like all about all of the focaccias everywhere, stuffed with mortadella, burrata, and whatnot. I'm happy for that to continue, and it can continue into the fall and winter as far as I'm concerned. Doesn't have to be a summer thing. Let's talk a little bit about the restaurants that were left off the list, because I, you know, I feel like whenever a list like this happens, and we just saw it with the 101, we saw it with the 101, the Bill Addison released last week. It's always a point of conversation for folks, you know, to express their disagreement, sometimes in good-natured manners, sometimes in less good-natured manners. But I would imagine that there are a couple restaurants that folks kept mentioning again and again when it came to the BNR list that they were maybe surprised to see left off. First one is one that I was personally quite happy to see left off, but I would just like to hear from you guys why you thought, hey, we don't need to include this. And that's Funky in Beverly Hills. Speaking of Beverly Hills,
this review was covered by one of our other writers who couldn't be here today, and you know, I think we liked Funky, and I think that writer did a really good job of sort of threading the needle in the review of giving the reasons why this restaurant has utility, why it's a fun place. But at this point, you know, that chef has pretty much a portfolio of very famous LA restaurants, right? And so we really had to place that in where Funky sat in the whole entirety of his portfolio, right? Because people are starting to ask, well, which ones do I actually need to go to? And at the end of the day, we made the choice that, like, of the other ones, like, Funky was not the one that you probably had to prioritize. There were other stronger reasons to go to some of his other restaurants. Are you still going to get really good pasta there? Like, absolutely. But at the end of the day, we just decided that stacking up to his own restaurants, Funky wasn't as high as the other ones.
Yeah, that makes sense to me. I, you know, when I saw it ranked so high on the 101, and then to also include Felix on there, that was something that I felt was kind of unnecessary, because I feel like I was very much in agreement with your reporter's review of that restaurant. Because I do think, isn't it like a third of the menu is things you can find at Felix, a third of the menu is a thing you can find at Mother Wolf, and then maybe there are a third original dishes. But to call it like its own thing, it feels like a little bit of an unnecessary, you know, statement in a city that already has so many great Evan Funky restaurants, let alone great pasta.
Exactly that. You know, like two-thirds of the menu is something you can find in the other restaurants. So when we took a step back and be like, well, what makes this restaurant singular and different from the other ones? That answer is a bit murky.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. Now to a restaurant that I like a lot. And it's Poltergeist in Echo Park. Now, I kind of want to give you guys a little bit of kudos, because I actually feel like you reviewed this restaurant before a lot of the other articles came out. Your review came out a month or more, if not multiple months, before Bill Addison's review in the Los Angeles Times, before Farley Elliott covered it in for Eater, before it started making all these Esquire lists, et cetera, et cetera. The Infatuation rarely puts out a review that's just negative, right? You're always looking for the positives, and you're talking about who can enjoy a meal in this place. But certainly compared to the other reviews that are out there on Poltergeist, it was a relatively negative review compared to what it's received. And now that everything else is out there, am I not seeing something that they are? Or am I sticking to my guns on this one?
Good question. So again, as we said, like, our site is like a living, breathing thing, right? So just because a restaurant has a specific rating on the site doesn't mean that that's going to be the rating forever. Like, we will check in on it and we will revisit it. And I've in my year and some change at the company have written new reviews on restaurants that have already existed on the site. So who knows when we'll revisit Poltergeist. Now, I'm going to stick to my guns on this, because my job at The Infatuation is to write my honest, unbiased opinion based on my personal experiences. So what is in the review is really my personal experience. Maybe other publications had a different experience, but I read the review and it does accurately reflect what I had at that restaurant. And I hope that I wrote a fair and balanced review, because I really, in the review, I really go into all the things that restaurant does really well. There also are some dishes that are just excellent. I say their Caesar salad is genuinely one of the best I've ever had. I love their honey, like their prawns that they have, like the honey walnut prawns. Like, I can go in detail about all the things I like about that place. But when I first visited it, I had a really good meal and I actually put it on the hit list and I was really excited about it. And so in my second and final visit, I brought my coworker, Nico, who couldn't be with us today. And I brought my social media manager to cover it because we had had it on hit list and we were going to promote it as a, give it, you know, more exposure. And I had a really, inconsistent second meal. Unfortunately, a lot of the things were just so salty that we couldn't really dig into them and enjoy them because it was just so overwhelmingly seasoned. And there were some things like they're so good at cooking protein. They're like different, like their lamb neck and their fish and their chicken is so good. But there would be a component or two in every dish that would kind of throw it off. So when it came to reviewing it, I needed to strike a balance where I highlighted what was good about it. And I honestly said what was not working. And so the rating landed, I believe, at like a 6.9. Just because, sevens usually mean that, you know, they're easily recommendable, like you'll probably enjoy them. But I had to just kind of like leave it floating just beneath it to be like, hey, there was kind of a common theme in this restaurant that wasn't really working at the time. So that's where it landed. But I thought it was so exciting when I first went. I think it's actually one of the most exciting openings that we had this year. We will revisit it. And very cool restaurant. It just when it came to reviewing it, it didn't work.
Well, I think you bring up a really interesting point, which is that it got a 6.9, and when you talk about how you think about your numerical ratings, a 7 is a restaurant you can easily recommend. And I can understand why you would say, I don't know that I can easily recommend this to everybody. And I think that that's also reflected in the other reviews the restaurant has received. I mean, even Bill Addison's review, which I think was overall positive, had like sort of like some caution flags in there, if you will, of like, hey, there are some swings here. And so not all of them, you know, really are really that successful. Some of them still need a lot of work, but you can sort of recognize the idea. So if we're looking at it through a lens of, can I easily recommend this to everybody and guarantee that they're going to, you know, be happy with how they spent their money and whatnot, I can see how you got there, basically.
No shade to them. It's a really cool restaurant. I had a really fun time both times I went there. It's just our job is to provide a service to our readers and say, hey, this is what you can expect. This is what you're going to get. Maybe it's for you, maybe it's not for you, but you know, make of it what you will. It's based on my personal experience.
I want to talk about this a little bit through the lens of Spotify Wrapped, which, you know, we've had our feeds flooded with for the last few weeks. But I saw a meme today that was something about December, sort of like the dead zone for Spotify Wrapped, because Spotify Wrapped tells you everything you listen to January through November. And then your next Spotify Wrapped begins in January. So December is sort of like your freebie month where you can like do whatever you want and it doesn't get like recorded. I'm curious, are there any like infatuation BNR like dead month gems that maybe have opened too recently to be considered a BNR in 2020 in 2023, but that, you know, it's too early to tell whether there'll be a BNR in 2024? Things that are sort of in that sweet spot of like, hey, we're interested in seeing how this progresses, but we don't really know what this is yet. Any of those restaurants on your sort of radar?
Well, I'll say, first off, that analogy was so good. I'm obsessed. I'm like still thinking about that. I was like, wait, that's so true.
For a second, I was like, wait, is this going to make any sense whatsoever? How many times am I going to have to repeat this? This is crazy. Yeah. But I'm glad you got it.
Honestly, it made too much sense. Too much sense. To answer that, yeah, there are a few places. A place that I just went to last week that is actually going to be going on our hit list in the next couple of days, spoiler, is this place, Etra. It is in Melrose Hill, sort of western in Melrose, and is kind of this cool, sort of dimly lit, not too serious Italian spot. And not really that red sauce Italian that we've been talking about, but just like a cool sort of like, Sylvia was actually the first one to say this, and I was like, it's so true. It feels like you're in this like kind of weird dim like wine bar in Berlin, right? Like you just walk in there and you're like, this is cool. I walked in there the first time and it was early because I didn't have a reservation. I walked in by myself and sat at the bar and it was like 5:30 at night. So early, right? And like the place was packed and full of just like beautiful people dressed so well. And I was like, where did you all come from? Like, who, were you just here? Like, and the doors opened and you were inside. Like, it's kind of one of those places, but the service is really strong. The food is mostly really great. I think there's a lot of things to be excited about. They literally opened last week. So like, they're still, I think, you know, just getting reps in, but that's one that's caught my eye.
It's a great answer. I've seen it pop up on social media already, so I've been curious to hear what people's reactions are. But that's definitely one I'll add to my own personal hit list, if you will. Silvio, how about you?
You know, this one's tricky because we know here at the Infatuation, we dine anonymously, which means that we have to wait for reservations like everybody else. Like when we get a table. But we just managed to get a table, or I managed to get a seat at a Sushi Sonagi over in Gardena. And it was one of the best meals I had all year. And we just couldn't get in. It's an 8-seat omakase. You know, we couldn't get in. And, you know, and we had our BNR wrapped and launched. And it's like, oh, darn. But fantastic, fantastic meal. Strongly recommend.
That's a good one. Have you have either of you been to or heard of Spina in Atwater Village?
It's on the list. It's on the list. I've been hearing some buzz about it.
No, I was just walking in Atwater Village a few weeks ago, and there was just a sign, and it just said Spina, and I just tweeted it out to people being like, hey, does anybody know what this is? I feel like this has popped out of nowhere. And then surely enough, I started seeing like, you know, Instagram stories about it everywhere. So that's on my... I need to go check that out soon, but I feel like that is a total, like, you know, Spotify rap dead zone type restaurant that just opened up.
Yeah.
Let's talk about restaurants that haven't even opened yet. Are there any restaurants that are opening up in 2024 that you know about that you're eagerly anticipating?
You know, we just had Uchi open up in West Hollywood last week or this past week. It's a sushi, or not sushi, it's actually a modern Japanese restaurant from Austin. That looks great. And we're trying to go sometime soon as well. And I think they're also, I read today that they're opening up a separate sushi concept in LA as well next year. So they're kind of doing a bigger expansion in the LA market. And Breadhead, I'm not sure if you've had Breadhead in Santa Monica. They've been operating out of Juneshine for a while now. They bake their focaccia fresh. That's another good focaccia sandwich. I think about their muffuletta all the time. They've been working on their brick and mortar for a while, and I'm really rooting for them, and I hope to see them open up soon on the West Side. So, really excited for them.
Yeah, it feels like they've been working on that space for a while. I've been eagerly anticipating it. I had their mozzarella sandwich, which I was like, "There's no way that anything with this many sprouts is going to be good," but it was just it turned out to be the perfect amount of sprouts. So. I think anything's possible with Breadhead. How about you, Brent? What are you looking forward to in 2024?
Let's see. I think the one place I've kind of circled is the full restaurant of Baby Bistro, which I don't know if that's even what the restaurant's going to be called. Baby Bistro was a kind of a three-month-long pop-up that happened in K-Town over the summer, and it was impossible to get into. I literally waited like 7 weeks to get in, and... went, had a great time, very cool French kind of bistro food, great wine and whatnot. And they're opening sometime in the spring, I think, maybe early summer in like an old Victorian house in Echo Park. And based off of what I experienced at the pop-up, good vibes there for sure. But, you know, I'll also say, like, I think on a broader level, I don't personally like pay that much attention to what are the big names coming down the pipeline. You know, we're talking 4 or 5 months in advance, only because like those restaurants, you know, tend to be, you know, either big name restaurants from out of town or just restaurants that have big PR backing to them. And there's nothing wrong with that, right? That's the game. I just, for my own personal, you know, self, I don't want to create an internal bias of being like, hey, man, I've been thinking about that restaurant opening for 5 months, but only because they have the money to feed you know, announcements into my inbox, right? Whereas there are going to be restaurants like they are every year that kind of fall out of the sky, are independently owned. And look, we're going to give all these restaurants a fair shot, right? But I just worry for my own self. If I'm constantly thinking about a place 4 or 5 months, I'm going to walk in with some sort of internal bias, right? And I try to keep the level, the playing field as level as possible. So, you know, I'm all for big restaurant openings, but I try not to overthink it.
I appreciate that. I feel like that's a great point and just made me think of the notion of like pop-ups. And I feel like every year there are so many amazing pop-ups that come up around town. How do you guys approach pop-ups?
It's kind of a case-by-case scenario. I would say we largely do not cover pop-ups. There are some pop-ups that are kind of, they're seen as permanent pop-ups that are entire different like dining concepts within other spaces, which then we will cover because that's essentially like that's a restaurant that just maybe is inhabiting another space. But Brant covered a Peruvian pop-up this year, Colibri, that was like a pop-up for like a year. It was going to be, it had like an expiration date. Like we are around for a year. And we were like, yeah, okay. You have a whole year to get there. That's a destination in our mind.
Certainly during the pandemic, we definitely cover pop-ups since that was very much part of the ecosystem. And it's not that like we don't love pop-ups or choose to ignore them by any means. But, you know, the tricky thing with our site, you know, we really pride ourselves on being evergreen in the sense that like the things that we publish, just from a utility standpoint, that the reader can click on it and know that that is the information that is correct. And it's just tricky with pop-ups, right? Like their hours always change. They might be in one location one week, or another location. And there's nothing wrong with that. It's just more from a very like nuts and bolts perspective. It's tricky. Whereas maybe when on social media, we might cover some pop-ups because that is, it's social media, right? It's there and then it goes away, right? And that I think is more of an avenue where we would cover pop-ups versus editorial. But again, just from a nuts and bolts perspective.
Yeah, that makes sense. I mean, when you talk about the utility of the website, how it's used, that totally makes sense. And also, you know, every publication seems to have their, what they're known for. Like Eater tends to quote unquote break news, right? LA Times has real estate for some more sort of like deep in the weeds policy pieces as well as what the other stuff that they do. So I want to end on this note because we have talked about Spotify Wrapped and now it's on the brain. I'm going to end with one question for both of you. If you had a top restaurant and top dish ordered in your personal Spotify What I Ate Wrapped, what would it be? The restaurant you went to the most and the dish you ordered the most, not at that restaurant, just in general at any restaurant.
Oh my God. And it has to be at a new restaurant, like a restaurant that opened in 20.
No, oh. Like literally, it could be like Sweetgreen. And the thing I ordered the most was the Mech fish because that's when I order when I'm hammered.
Okay. Well, I'm not going to actually answer how many times I went to Sweetgreen this year, but it's more than zero. So.
Luca, we eat so much food. Like this, it's like, you know, I'm debating between like 10 things in my head right now.
Okay. All right. I have two answers. One, I think the actual like best dish that I had, which kind of falls into the Spotify Wrapped restaurant. We talked about it a lot, but we're going to cover it next year, is this place Simon, which is this Panamanian restaurant that opened in the old James Beach space in Venice. They were still very into soft open mode when we were figuring out best new restaurant stuff. So we just ultimately decided to just sort of give them a second to breathe. There is a tuna tostada there that you're like, man, I've had so many of those. It literally is, it is so unbelievably good and so different. And I still think about that. I only had it twice so far because I'm going to go back a couple times before I review it. But I was like, that's the best thing I've had all year. And it was this like yucca tostada with this slim thing of fresh machine. Unbelievable. I think about it often. In terms of the actual food that I probably have eaten the most, this is a deep cut right here. And I'm going to go with the chips and salsa at El Coyote. And that is because
I love that. Okay, you understood the assignment. That is the assignment.
I understood the assignment, right? Okay, so I live, you know, El Coyote, classic Mexican spot. No one, been around since the dawn time. No one is going to tell you that the food there is all that good. I live close to it, and my boyfriend and I go there all the time. We can walk there, stumble home. That is like our Friday night spot where we'll just go have margaritas, and their chips and salsa are good. Like, it is good, and they will bring that out on, like, you do not have to ask. They will bring it out. So in terms of the food that I had the most, without question, the chips and salsa.
Excellent answer. A plus. All right, Silvio, you saw how this works. Now that you have that and there's no shame in the game, what's your answer?
Look, no shame in the game. But I think that the tie between the best things I ate this year were pretty much like any of the cuts at Tacos Los Cholos. Like, I genuinely thought that was, like, for me, like, my restaurant this year. I love them. And we actually flew them out to EatsCon New York, and they were wildly popular because they killed it. They were amazing. So say that maybe, like, the ribeye taco at Taco Los Cholos or the lump rice at Baja Subs Market and Deli, Brant took me because we were revisiting our best restaurants in Los Angeles. And I hadn't been before, so we went as a team. And it's this beautiful rice dish that comes, like, wrapped in banana leaf, and you open it and there's, like, beef and a boiled egg and spices, and it's sweet, and it's like, I have a high spice tolerance, and I was like actually sweating in the restaurant.
Not to, like, fully throw you under, but you ate that so fast. He got the hiccups in the restaurant as he ate it so fast. I was like, you're going to choke. You're going to actually
choke. It was so good. I was just, like, inhaling it. I was sweating and hiccuping, and they were videotaping me, and I was just this, I was, my nose was running. It was an out of body experience. Please, everyone listening, go to Baja Subs in Northridge and get that. Amazing.
I was going to say that's a sign of a good time. That's how you know you've done it right. Hiccups, sweating, breathing fast, that's what you want.
Yeah. Heart palpitations, my favorite.
Silvio, Brant, just want to say thank you for joining us today. It's been an absolute delight learning about BNR, learning about how it all comes together, and just hearing your rather delightful takes. It's been an absolute, you know, holiday treat. So thank you for making the time for us.
Hey, thank you for having us. We'll come back anytime.
Beware saying that, because we will take you up on that. But without further ado, happy holidays, guys.
Happy holidays.
Likewise. Happy holidays.
Thanks for listening to another episode of the LA Food Podcast. Thanks to Brant and Silvio from The Infatuation for joining us. Always a pleasure to speak with them. If you like what you heard today, dear listener, please go to wherever you listen to podcasts, leave us a rating, a review, subscribe. Seriously, it's super helpful when you go and leave us a 5-star rating on Apple, Spotify. Helps us make our way up those pesky charts. Look, we'll be back next week with what I'm calling our LA Food Podcast Holiday Party featuring Father Saul. It's a pretty exciting episode, so be sure to tune in. But if you're looking for me in the meantime, you can find me on TikTok, Instagram, and even Threads at the LA Countdown. That's TheLaCountdown. You can also find me on Instagram at LA Food Pod. That's LAFOOD POD.